Echoes of War is a project documenting local veterans, their families, and survivors of war, and their experience of coming home. Participants gathered for 4 nights in October 2015 at the Arcata Playhouse in a live theatrical event to share their life stories with local audiences. Echoes of War is an original production from Four on the Floor Theater and the Arcata Playhouse. It is partially funded by the California Humanities Community Stories Project. To view companion images to this broadcast, please visit our website, echoesofwar.org. That's echoesofwar.org.
They gave us a B-24 of our own and said, this is yours, take care of it. And that's what I did. I went crawled over that plane like it was a weevil and making sure there was nothing wrong with it. And there was a certain pride in it. This is our plane, and our plane is better than anybody else's plane, of course. And our crew, of course, is better than anybody else's crew. My name is Bob Block. I was a tech sergeant in the Air Force during World War II, flying as flight engineer on B-17s and B-24s. I would have enlisted sooner, but my mother remembered my father being in World War I. She asked me, please, not to enlist till after her birthday, which was June 25th. And June 26th, I went in and signed up. And our first real mission was a very short one, just going out across the channel to bomb the sites from which they were sending up the buzz bombs over to London. You really couldn't feel sorry if you bombed a civilian accidentally. In fact, when we went back to France in 1994, we stayed at a gîte, a bed and breakfast near Normandy, and the owner of it was a younger fellow who told me that his mother had been killed during one of our bombing raids. He said he didn't blame us for his mother's death. He knew what we had to do, but he obviously forgave me because he gave us a bottle of homebrewed Calvados when we left. When I came home from England, they flew us into Floyd Bennett Field in Brooklyn, and I took the subway without even telling my parents that I was coming home. And I thought better of it at the subway station, and I phoned from across the street from where my folks lived just to tell them I'd be home. So, I had been through my war. I thought I had grown up as much as I could, and the best thing that happened to me at home was the GI Bill. Going to high school, it was Depression days, and I knew I was never going to go to college. If I hadn't gotten to college, and I couldn't have afforded it without the GI Bill, I would have been working in a factory or in the gas station for the rest of my life. The one thing I can tell you about coming home, about being different, being a civilian, when I got into college, finally, I was serious about it. And there was a young fellow who was right out of high school. He was showing how much he knew by answering all the questions that the professor had and what I was trying to learn. And he would ask a question. And one day, when he asked the question, I pulled my pocket knife out, opened it up, and jammed it into the desk of my chair, and I said to him, shut the hell up, and I don't think he talked for the rest of the year. But I've been to some of the reunions and met some of the fellows, and it was nice, but some of the pilots would tell me stories of how they had met some of the German fighter pilots after the war, and comparing notes with them and being friendly with them. And I just didn't have the strength or the desire to have anything to do with a German fighter pilot or a German soldier, for that matter. I guess they were doing what they were told to do. They fought for their country, or somehow I have never even been able to buy a Volkswagen. I joined what I did because I thought there was a reason for it. There was something to be defended. It was something that people did because it was something that needed doing. And I don't know anything, any place that we are now that we really need to be.
You have to take a leap of faith when you're in the military that the person to your side or in the front or the back is going to be there through thick and thin because you never know how a person is going to react.
Mike Nickerson, Staff Sergeant, United States Marine Corps.
When you're being shot at or in a combat zone, anywhere where your life is really in danger 24 hours a day, that bond that develops is something that you take with you to the grave. And that friendship is more of a kindredship, a family, than a friend, because you are family. That's something civilians don't understand, and they never will. You might be a member of a frat, or you played on a high school championship football game, or college in a very distinguishable career, whatever, but is that guy that's on the football field with you, is he gonna take a bullet for you? I'd venture to say no. I mean, 31 years ago, this happened, and I still have very vivid memories and dreams. And that's just something people don't understand. That's just a fact of life. I love Humboldt County. I came through here back in 1977 for the first time. From what I have seen since I've been out here, I think the veteran support in Humboldt County is up there with the best, most historic cities in America. Because there's just everybody here just seems to be a little more hardcore American, I guess is a way to put it. You see flags on almost every other house has a flag out. You don't see that in towns anymore except for the small towns. People here have been fantastic. My medical care and everything like that is second to none. I've had nothing but phenomenal care since I gotten out, medical-wise and stuff. Trying to get pensions and stuff like that for injuries that happened 30 years ago, I'm still fighting to this day, so that's disheartening. My body has taken a lot of beatings over the years, jumping out of airplanes and everything else. It's just broken down. I mean, I'm not a teenager anymore. I don't heal like I was. Being able to hold regular employment has definitely been an issue, whether it be for physical limitations or PTSD issues that I still am dealing with. And running out of money and stuff, everything, you end up losing your home. I ended up homeless. So, well, no income due to no work, because I couldn't work because my physical limitations and my mental issues, I guess you could call them, that happened. People just don't like hiring you. And if you don't have a job, you're not going to have a house. You don't have a house, what are you going to do? That's the main reason I'm so disgruntled, per se, at the VA is my disabilities and stuff that may happen in the military. I should be at least compensated so I can at least live a life, a normal life, instead of not know where I'm going to be at from month to month, week to week even. Got about 7-8 months, and then I'll be back on the streets again if I don't get some kind of pension or my disability figured out. I mean, put somebody in one of our shoes and let them understand that there's often more things behind the scenes than a person ever realizes. Don't be too quick to judge, because you don't know. I'm guilty of it, and now I've been on both sides, so take care of yourself and family, if you have one, and just know there's always somebody there to help if you need it, because there is help out there.
Hello, good evening. My name is Wendy Ann Linderborg, and I had the honor of serving as an Army nurse in the reserves for 16 years. I was a member of the 352nd Combat Support Hospital in Oakland, California, and my job was training medics in the emergency room at Alameda County Medical Center in trauma care. And in 2003, I was deployed to Kosovo for Operation Joint Endeavor. I worked there in the intensive care unit at Camp Bondsteel, where we cared for many soldiers of different nationalities, as well as Albanians and Serbians, in life or limb situations. We also went into the villages in convoys, where we administered medical and dental care to the people. And some of them had never seen a doctor before in their lives. I remember how grateful they were to us. And in one village, after we had given the medical care, they wanted to do something for us. So they got some honey and watermelon, and we all sat down and ate it together. And at the top of the hill was this mound, and they pointed to it and said, well, that's where most of our family are. You know, it's a mass grave. And I was like, I was so upset over that. It was so devastating. We also helped in the local hospitals, and many of our patients were orphans from the war, which was really heartbreaking. There was so much that needed to be done for them. They had burns and all kinds of wounds, some of them, and just without parents. There was so much to be done for them. It just wasn't enough time. When I left Kosovo, I had a heavy heart to leave those people behind who were still suffering. There was still so much to be done to help. I felt guilty going home, too, because I knew some of our soldiers that I worked with weren't going home, such as some soldiers with whom I had breakfast in the morning. That night, they died in a helicopter crash. When I arrived home, it was hard to readjust because people had changed and so had I. And it was a lonely feeling, but being with other veterans really helps, sharing the stories, and there's a lot of camaraderie there. Thank you for listening to my story.
Hello, my name is Azra Andy Sehik. I'm a Bosnian Muslim genocide survivor. Coming home, in my case, meant to be reunited with my family to another continent, from Bosnia to California. Bosnia and Herzegovina is a beautiful small country in Eastern Europe, across from Italy, with lots of mixed cultures and religions. My birth town, Sarajevo, is the capital of Bosnia and Herzegovina. In 1984, we had Winter Olympic Games, and the whole world heard about our beautiful mountains around the capital and the generosity and hospitality of the people. I was one of the volunteers on the Olympic Games. Fast forward to 1992, the world heard again about Sarajevo and Bosnia for a very different reason. Overnight, the Serbian forces surrounded Sarajevo from those beautiful mountains, and Sarajevo was under siege until 1995, the longest siege known in Europe. Genocide in Bosnia was the most horrible one after World War II. Over 100,000 Bosnian Muslims perished forever, and there were over a million refugees who fled the country. For me personally, it was a scary and devastating time, as I have escaped death many times. Shelling, bombing, sniper bullets were my daily challenges, on top of not having enough food or power or gas, water, even phones, as Serbian forces had cut all the supplies off. It was a horrible awakening to learn that some of my coworkers, neighbors, and one of my best friends hid the information about the upcoming war and went on the Serbian side, oppressor side. One quiet morning on May 27, 1992, while my cousin and their kids were asleep in my condo, I was getting ready to go to a nearby distribution spot to buy some bread. Bread was an essential part of the table. As we would break the bread together, it made us feel normal again. I had completed all my morning chores and got ready to leave my condo, and then I remembered, I didn't feed my dog. Feeling guilty as how could I possibly forget that, I put my shopping bag down and prepared his food. And then the big bomb fell down nearby that shook the whole building. My family was all awake now. We all got quiet while knowing the scenario of the oppressor from the mountains, that two more bombs would follow. Hours later, Wim went out to find out what happened. It was the breadline that got hit. 26 people killed and 108 injured. I escaped the death one more time. I have lived through 10 months of madness of war in Bosnia, where Muslims were killed strategically. I left my extended family to be a refugee in Czech Republic for another 10 months. Fleeing from Bosnia and being a refugee in a country that didn't want us was a traumatic on its own way. Thanks to UNHCR in Prague, I was reunited with my parents in Los Angeles. At that time, end of 1993, coming home meant a physical place of existence. I was relieved to have my family around me, as we would help each other in times of hardship, share happy times, and break the bread together. Coming home also meant emotional place in me, and that part is still in the process. As I work on my inner and outer peace, I learn the importance of acknowledging of the pain and the suffering in me and the world. Listening people who have gone through trauma that are from Bosnia, Darfur, Palestine, and Native Americans, I realized how essential it is to all of us to be heard, and that we all have a story to share. Being a Muslim, I've heard a lot of criticizing of Muslims. That is really a hard one for me to process. All I want is peace and harmony in the world, as many other Muslims and non-Muslims across the globe. My journey became my lifestyle, be the change you want to see in the world, to help people in need through numerous community projects, serving on boards of nonprofit organizations, fundraising for good causes, volunteering in peace organizations such as Arlington West, Women International League for Peace and Freedom, the local branch right here in Arcata, to planting over 150 fruit trees and berry bushes with my friends and community in low-income housing at the Arcata Courtyard. Also establishing a group, True Entertainment, whose aim is to empower community connection through inspiring art and film. In November, we will have a film festival of shorts right here at the Arcata Playhouse called To Action. I have also engaged with local peace organizations to submit a request for a proclamation of an International Day of Peace, which Arcata City Council approved at last year. This year, I had a vision to plant as many peace poles around Arcata. So far, there is 9 peace poles planted, and all of them are made by our local artists. One peace pole was planted at the Arcata City Hall lawn, which represents who we are as a city and what we strive to be as a community. All these projects mean a lot to me that inspire and empower deeper and peaceful connection in the community as a vital element in our existence. I would like the world to know that my war experience made me who I am today. My hunger for peace, my belief in earth peace, like the need for the bread peace, to love and be loved, and not to be right, as my sister would say. And most importantly, I want all the troops back home where they belong to break the bread with their family, friends, and community. Thank you very much.
I'm a Sergeant Matthew Coleman. I'm from Fortuna, California. I am currently active National Guard. I'm with the 132nd Multi-Role Bridge Company out of Eureka, Reading, and Mount Shasta. I just want to recognize this group. I just can't tell you how much it's meant to me to work with all of you. It's been an amazing experience. I'm leaving this with more questions than I had when I first walked into this room. And I really think this group, we make a great team. I'm really proud of being part of that team and serving in this capacity with all of you. My story tonight is emails that I wrote home to my wife, who's in the audience tonight, and my son. So my readings were written late in December, and it was towards the end of my deployment. I was part of a bridge company. We built bridges and helped with road builds and those types of things. First of all, as my family, you served your country with honor, and you need to be proud of that. I know it was tough, and you don't get the credit back home, but you served right alongside of me. I think back to July of 2011 when we sat down as a family and we talked about this deployment. I said then I would serve so you wouldn't have to, but the reality is you served as well. Take that serious, as I know you do. Late in November, I came back from a bridge recon with a route clearance patrol from North Dakota. I rode in an RG-31 that is used by route clearance patrols. 4 days later, on the 3rd of December, two soldiers from that platoon were killed in an RG-31 on Highway 1, the same route we took getting back to Leatherneck. I have never been scared, worried, but have always known the risks and realities of this place. We have had a protective bubble around us this entire deployment, and that is something I will never be able to explain. I know about prayer, luck, and all those things, but others have prayer too, and yet they are injured or die. There were times at Fob Pasab when I thought I was having a heart attack. I was having chest pains, and any normal person would have called it quits. All I had to do was go to the medic, and I would have been pulled from mission. I know this was not the smartest thing to do, and I could have been putting my team at risk, but I just couldn't quit. I have a few trigger dates that were more serious and some really life-changing moments. One of them was May 20th. I was wondering to myself, how much could I take? I would go through three options in my mind. One, I would make it back at the end of the day. Two, I would be medevaced out, injured, or dead. Or three, I would give up on and have myself pulled from the mission. This was never an option, although at times it crossed my mind. Along these lines, many times I would hope that I would be injured rather than have to deal with one of my teammates being injured. I would quickly pull my mind back from these thoughts and tell myself, neither option was worth wasting my time worrying about. Trigger dates are May 20th, July 31st, August 6th, and August 30th. These dates are significant because I saw the cold, hard realities of this place and how quick things can change and change lives forever. For me, I had a front row seat to the fight against the Taliban. Time is winding down. We are inside 40 days and counting. We have one more big bridge mission and a couple of smaller missions, and we will be done. I think the bridge mission will be it for me, and my outside the wire count will be somewhere in the neighborhood of 106 days. The bridge mission is keeping us busy right now, and that is probably good. I spent the last 4 days at the bridge site with the lieutenant getting some last minute planning done. We flew up and caught a ride back with route clearance patrol. You know, I have the badges and the awards and the ribbons that you earn as being a serviceman, but the greatest gift and the greatest award that I received was just being able to come home to my family and be done with my deployment. Thank you.
My name is Jim Sloan. I served in the U.S. Navy aboard an aircraft carrier, the USS Coral Sea, from 1961 through 1963. This time is considered Cold War service. Although we were briefly offshore of Vietnam, providing air cover for the first combat Marines that went into Vietnam in 1963. There had been advisors in Vietnam since 1958. I was discharged in 1963. The anti-war movement had not yet started. I never felt that I was a Vietnam veteran. Coming home is not an event. It is a process. My own coming home didn't begin until 42 years later. In 2004, my children were grown, I was retired and divorced, and had a lot of time on my hands. I heard of a project that was involved in bringing a replica of the Vietnam Wall to Southern California, where I was living. They were looking for volunteers to help. I went to a meeting, soon found myself being part of the escort when the wall came into town. I helped set it up. I spent a couple of nights with some other people reading the 58,000 names on that wall. It was an around-the-clock effort that took 3 days and three nights to complete. The wall was boxed up and went off to the next town. A few months later, I heard of another group called Run for the Wall. Run for the Wall started their first run in 1989, when about 115 motorcycles, ridden mostly by Vietnam vets, left San Diego for Washington, D.C. on a prisoner of war, missing in action awareness run that would end at the Vietnam Wall. Most of the motorcycles turned back in Las Vegas, but about 15 made it all the way to the wall. Each day of this 10-day trip has special meaning to those that participate. Parades through small towns, visits to veterans' hospitals, and memorials. But one has special meaning. The 15 riders that first year found themselves in West Virginia, negotiating with a toll road operator. They wanted to pay one toll for all the bikes and go through the gates without stopping. It's not easy to stop a motorcycle and try to hold it up while you're searching through your pockets with gloves on, trying to find the right change. The toll road operators insisted that each motorcycle would have to stop and pay its own toll. So in typical military fashion, if you can't go through it, you go around it. The riders got off the main road and took the back roads through the hills of West Virginia. Almost 2 hours later, they came across a coal mining town named Raynell. Raynell was bigger than Blue Lake, not quite as big as Arcata. The riders found that there was some kind of an event going on. There were people lining the road, many holding flags. A couple of the riders went into town to find a way through without interfering with the event. They asked for directions and were told the people were waiting for the veterans on motorcycles. Someone along the way had called the local sheriff to report that there were a bunch of veterans on motorcycles heading their way. The town had shut down many businesses, the school, and most other activities to come out and recognize the veterans. They invited them into the school to meet the kids, have lunch in the cafeteria. Run for the Wall has been going back to Raynell for 27 years. We still have lunch in the school cafeteria and meet the kids. The kids come out with homemade autograph books and ask us to sign them. I once overheard a teacher say, as soon as the kids come back from Christmas vacation, they start asking, when do the motorcycles get here? Coming in second place to Santa is a pretty good place to be. Some of the riders have been doing this long enough that they're now meeting the children of the kids that first met them at the school many years ago. We each see the kids get a little bit older each year. The next day, Run for the Wall arrives in Arlington, Virginia, and the following morning visits the National Cemetery, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and the Vietnam Wall. In May of 2015, Run for the Wall riders gathered in Ontario, California, and 1,000 motorcycles started this ride once again. I have been participating in the run for 10 years, once on a motorcycle, from then on in my pickup truck, because I'm smarter than they are. I often towed a trailer and picked up motorcycles when they broke down, take them to a dealer to get them repaired so they can rejoin us. I once took my own travel trailer and then spent the summer on the East Coast. Most recently, I am the last man vehicle and the chase truck coordinator. You may have noticed my truck out in front when you came in with the lights flashing. That truck and I have driven the equivalent of around the world following motorcycles to Washington, D.C. With a little luck, the pickup and I will do it again in 2016. The process of coming home continues. For many of the riders, this is the parade and the welcome home that they did not get 40 years ago. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Tisha Sloan. That lovely man is my father. A few years after he started going on the run for the wall, he started bugging me to go with him. I didn't really get why. I'm not a vet. And I didn't understand how I belonged there, what my role was. But after a few years, I finally gave in and figured out with my family how to make it work. And I went on the run. in the truck. The very first night at the staging hotel, I went down to the lobby for a drink before going to bed, and I met Terry, a biker and veteran from Las Vegas, sitting next to me. Right off the bat, he told me that the riot had made a different person out of him. He'd never been able to talk about his experiences in Vietnam. And then he paused. He was crying. We'd been talking for about 2 minutes. Then he said he wouldn't be going all the way, a run for the wall battle cry, meaning you make the entire trip from LA to DC, because he had to go back to Vegas for medical treatments. He told me very matter-of-factly that he had cancer due to Agent Orange. Explaining further how much the run meant to him, he told me how on his first run in 03, he hadn't been able to bring himself to go down to the wall when they got there. He stayed back up on the pathway. His second year, a couple of guys who had noticed this came and took him by the hand and brought him down to the wall. He looked at me and said, "Do you see? I was beginning to." A few days into the run, we reach Angel Fire, New Mexico. We're at the site of the very first Vietnam Memorial in the United States. Looks like a white sail rising up out of the hills of New Mexico. A father started building it 5 days after finding out he had lost his son in Vietnam in 1968. This was the first really emotional stop on the run. The guys were tearing up and starting to really talk. There's now a small Vietnam museum there and a monument of a downed Huey helicopter where I met Jaime from Santa Clarita. He told me about the Huey helicopter crash that only he walked away from. And he said that when he came home, he left his uniform in the airport bathroom after changing so no one would know that he was a soldier. And he never talked about it again until coming on the ride. "Now," he said, "I'm not alone. I travel with a pack." I was beginning to realize what my role was here on the ride. It was that of witness, to just be there with these men and women and hear their stories. Days later, we reached Wentzville, Missouri. As we pulled up to the VFW, I was riding with Jaime on the back of his bike, and on the side of the road, I saw an older woman standing there with everyone else greeting the riders. For some reason, I was compelled to jump off the bike and make my way over to her, and I put my hand out to shake her hand. She pushed it out of the way and took me into a very strong hug and said, "Thank you for coming here." I again felt like I didn't deserve the gratitude due to the vets that I was riding with, but I also recognized that this woman and I shared that role of being on the sidelines, only able to witness and appreciate and listen. It was hot and humid when we arrived in DC, and the area around the wall was packed. I had a name to find for a friend to take a rubbing. As I was doing so, a woman touched my arm from behind and tearfully said, "I'm so sorry for your loss." I started to explain that it wasn't my loss, I was doing this for a friend, but those words just seemed stupid. The loss belongs to all of us. So I accepted her hug and said simply, "Thank you." One of my big takeaways from going on the run is that I lost sight of the us and them of the whole thing. We're all us. We're all hurt and make sacrifices and are made to do things that we don't want to do. We're all broken. I have come to understand that this is how the light gets in. Not all interactions are about actions. Sometimes we just need to be heard, and sometimes we're just there to listen. These vets were extremely grateful to me for being there, for listening. Thank you for being here and for listening.
You're listening to Echoes of War, an original production of Four on the Floor Theater and the Arcata Playhouse, documenting local veterans, their families, and survivors of war. For more information and to view companion images to this broadcast, please visit our website, echoesofwar.org. That's echoesofwar.org.
Well, the title of my story is California Dreaming.
Rob Hepburn, United States Marine Corps.
When I was 18, I was working at a China factory in South Jersey, and me and my girlfriend Susie were planning on moving out to California to become hippies. We continually listened to the Mamas and Papas, California Dreaming, and that was our dream. But instead, a day after my 19th birthday, I joined the Marine Corps. And the way I got out to California was via Parris Island and more training in North Carolina, and then jungle training in California before being shipped off to Vietnam. While in Vietnam, I was an eyewitness to atrocities. A few months before the end of my tour, there was a particular incident where three old mama sons got too close to the wire while digging roots and were blown apart by our M50s. And then later the next morning, three teenagers from the village, two boys and a girl, attacked the fence with their bare hands. They were blown apart too, but one was still alive. He was lying on the ground and his blood had to foot, and he was just asking for nook, just water in Vietnamese. The medics were standing around him, pouring their canteens on the ground around him and spitting on him. So I ran over to him to offer him water. I got the canteen to his mouth. I would hope to think that he had a little bit of moisture before he died. But I was pulled away from other troops. Later, at least three other troops came to my hooch and attacked me. And I received a severe head wound from the butt end of an M16 into my head and went unconscious. I came to consciousness in the back of a truck going to a field medevac hospital. After that, I was sent to Wei. Wei was being overrun by the NVA and the Viet Cong during the Tet Offensive. I guarded an arms dump, and it was a miracle that we survived that. I don't remember much about, it seems like I only have visual memories of a lot of things. I remember the next thing, I was on an airplane coming home, and I came back to New Jersey, back to Southern New Jersey, and I really don't remember anybody talking to me or me talking to anybody else. It was like coming home to nothing. I do remember getting on the bus and arriving in Los Angeles, California. Then I wound up on the streets for about a year and a half, almost 2 years, on the streets of LA. And I finally did wind up getting a job at a health food store, and I grew my hair down to past my waist. And then I moved to San Francisco and immediately joined the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. That became my extended family, my compañeros in the Vietnam Vets Against the War. And I found my home in the peace movement.
I'm Roy Marin. I'm a Vietnam veteran from 1969-70. Before that, home for me was a couple acres 3 miles west of town on the bend of a creek in ridiculously beautiful western Sonoma County. My friends and I would ride our horses through the apple orchards and up into the redwood-covered hillsides. Home was located on a bend of a creek, which had been a Native American village site. The rich alluvial soil was further enriched by the cinders and ashes from their fires. I found shell fragments and obsidian arrowheads. There was an old barn, a two-story tank house, and an artesian well. Really. I graduated from high school in 1966. There was something new in the air. The hipsters from the Haight-Ashbury were moving up into the country. Morning Star Ranch, one of the first communes, was located just a couple miles up the road. I started hanging out there. I started digging the groovy people. The music was appealing. I dug the style and the fashions, like feminism's abandonment of the brassiere. A 19-year-old's dream come true. I turned on and tuned in the TV and watched as we invaded Vietnam, beat up civil rights and war protesters as American soldiers were dying in the rice paddies. Within that year, 1967-68, I turned on, tuned in, dropped out, and got drafted. Every guy my age, 19 years, 10 months, would be conscripted into the United States Army, drafted, hauled off in a bus, and sent off to war. Without a student deferment, physically fit American males went off to war no matter how they felt about it. One choice was to run. I rode with a friend to the Canadian border and watched him walk across a bridge. Then I drove his van back home to someone he had sold it to. If you fled your country to avoid a bad war, you were relinquishing your citizenship. You could never come back. I know that sounds ridiculous now, and the Amnesty Act, after a failed war, welcomed back all those who had fled. At the time, in the late 60s, that was the reality. I loved my home and my family and my friends too much. For them and for myself, I left home so I could hopefully return home. When the call came, I rode the bus to Oakland for my pre-induction physical. I envied the guy standing next to me. He had a club foot and a glass eye. He had two things to keep him home. I had nothing. He stayed home. A month later, I rode the one-way bus to Oakland. It's hard to be a hippie in the Army. They go way out of their way to discourage any culture counter to their own. I hadn't asked for this, but in a way, basic training was good for me. I gained weight. I got in shape. I learned to work within an organized community, teamwork. I learned to deal with adversity. Whatever ego I possessed was broken down and passed around. I learned how to fold my socks and my underwear, polish my boots, shine my brass. I learned self-defense, hand-to-hand combat, bayonet training. I scored expert on the rifle range. I would encourage all teenagers to undergo some form of basic training as they become adults. Meanwhile, back in the Army in 1968, they told us what to do next. You got trained to do a job, anything from killing people to filling out paperwork. Before the all-volunteer Army, soldiers were trained to do everything. One soldier in seven was trained for combat. The rest of us learned to cook for him, drive in his supplies, house him and record his files, plan and follow his actions, fly in air support, find him after the battle, patch him up, or haul out and tag his body, load him up and send him home. I was one of the lucky ones. I learned to drive, not tanks, not armored vehicles, trucks, 1 tons and deuce and a halfs. Not that guys driving trucks didn't get blown up and die, but in Vietnam it was a pretty good job and I was relatively safe. We lived in barracks on a depot in a seaport city, white sand beaches. We did our jobs and then we came back and hung out and played our music on PX reel-to-reel stereos. We watched the fireworks on the mountain, gunships firing tracers, choppers dropping flares hanging from parachutes, the explosions of the rockets on the hillsides. Pretty trippy, accompanied by Hendrix and Santana. Every week or so, we pulled guard duty in some tower or fuel dump. There was no doubt a war was going on around us. We got hazardous duty pay. My years slid by. When I came home, I hitchhiked from the airport in my uniform with my duffel bag. Took about 3 rides. I asked the last guy to drop me off at my road. I walked the last mile and surprised my folks by simply walking in the door. Then I reinserted myself back into the counterculture, which had become the popular culture of the moment. Since then, I've been asking myself what it means to be a veteran. I think about it a lot. I don't talk about it. I haven't related myself to that. But then I was invited to go on the honor flight. It was a wild 3-day weekend, I can't tell you, in Washington, D.C. I got this cool hat. And it made me stop and think about, I'm glad I went, and I'm happy to be back. Thank you.
I enlisted in Eureka. It was 1980. There was no work, and one day I was there talking to the yeoman, which was admin work, and that's what I did. And I asked him, I said, you got anything for me to do? I'll help. And he said, why don't you go talk to the recruiter? I said, oh, I hadn't thought about it. In military, do I want to have somebody tell me what to do? And I did. My name is Mercedes Kangas, and I was a petty officer, second class, otherwise known as an E5. The beginning, I worked for officers that I really respected and that had my back anytime, every time I got medals and commendations for the work I did, because I didn't mind going 100+%. I am glad I served, because you are part of a brotherhood and sisterhood that's like nothing else. This is a job that it never ends. I mean, imagine going to work and then at night you have dinner with your coworkers, you go to sleep with your coworkers. So, you know, they're your family, whether you like them or not. Their family. And and one of the things I realized coming back here was how much of a family that is. I worked at the Veterans Center and I kept hearing the boys talk about Blue Ox. Blue Ox this, Blue Ox that. I want to go. I came here, I walked in, it's really nice. Eric was over at the Forge and he's walking us around and talking about the property, and I'm like a kid, this is so nice. And he goes, Eric goes, Mercedes, I hear that you love to do crafts and stuff like that. I said, yes. So he grabs this box of clay and puts it in front of me. I got a job for you. I need you. I said, I've never done anything with clay. Oh, I have faith in you. And that was it. I was hooked. Like now, I am older, I'm 56 years old, and I always end up being the older in the group around the vets, and I love it. And I love these boys and girls coming back, and they're so hurt. They're so screwed up sometimes, and I love working with them. I love being around them. There's Andrew around here. And he has a problem with people. He's very shy. And I jump him. I do. I hug him. It's like, oh, Donna! I mean, I wouldn't do it to somebody that, you know, if I, you know, I check the waters, because if you come one of these boys from behind, you might get hurt. I wish I could known that I would love working with my hands way more than I like working with my brain. If I could restart over again, I would be doing something like this. I was a little bit inwards. You know, I have no problem, I think, communicating. And I used to be overblown. And I had come back down on that and slowly started talking to tourists, telling them about Blue Ox. About the third time or fourth time I'm doing this, talking to them, showing them what I'm doing, it's when I realize I'm okay. I am really okay. And I will be.
Hello, my name is Sean McCarthy. I was in the United States Marine Corps from 2002 to 2007. I am a combat veteran. I'm going to perform two spoken word poems. What is a hero? Is it openly admitting your sexual preference to a country that hasn't learned to accept it? Is it the sacrifice that soldiers make every day for the freedoms of our forefathers protected? What is a hero? Is it the rifle of a Marine on a battlefield? One step could be his last. Believe in the resurrection, said the Reverend, but he no longer accepts it for God or country. What is a hero? Do we question that women are equal to men, but on the battlefield they bleed like men? Why do we say no, they can't, when two said they could and they did it with all odds against them? What is a hero? Is it okay to believe in a God that denies a person a heaven? How can we live in a world so imperfect if we are all created perfect? What is a hero? Is it a veteran returning from war now has to learn to survive? 22 die a day, that's 22 since 1965. Multiply that by 365, and I promise you, you will be surprised. One too many die overseas. Compare that number to 401,000. What is a hero? You climb out of the stump, 100 pounds to hump, your knees are given out, and so are your lungs. The doctor's yelling cancer, and you might not win. But if you open your heart and continue to fight, you know you can, sir. What is a hero? The homeless. It may not be what it seems. Too many veterans sleep in the streets. What's the difference between that and a foxhole? I'll tell you, the government becomes the enemy. What is a hero? You see, we all get caught up on the hottest trends. Fox, CNN, careful what you say. Freedom of speech is allowed. God forbid you say God out loud. God bless America. What is a hero? Kazuko. In Japanese, it means family. You see, in the Japanese culture, there's an emphasis on family. My family, there are two. My mother, Okasan. She's the constant inspiration of willfulness, stubbornness of my family. My mother's frail fingers casually caressed 62 years of her life. Her arthritis tells stories. Her index finger, crooked gracefully, points me down memory lane to a time when I first saw her smile. First saw her hands painless, holding a traditional Japanese fan, moving crowds like wind. A 4'4" tsunami dress in a kimono face paint and culture. How beautiful to be able to tell stories with no microphone. No literary device, just a choreographed version for the love of the stage and the connection to the people. You see, there have been years I've forgotten where I've come from. I've assimilated to a culture that easily tends to forget. I'm torn because I'm half Japanese and half American. Caught in between love and hate, like an explosion of a kamikaze pilot on a U.S. battleship, like the aftermath of an atomic bomb. My mother waits till I become nuclear and lets the conversation radiate, only to wish my pain and assimilate it to her chest so I can be free, like a summer rain, like a moon on a clear night, like a cherry blossom in the spring, free. She has watched me through 3 deployments, 2 prison terms, and 1 divorce. And any time she would sacrifice herself just to give me a little freedom. She would mend rice balls like a broken heart and feed them in my chest if I needed one. Her feet are deformed from dancing on decades, and sometimes I think my heart and her English were the only thing we have in common, both broken. Like a record spinning on a cracked soundtrack to my family's harmony. You see, I could spell resilience, but my mother could describe it. But once you realize that earthquakes are coming from your faults, you realize how deep trembles are felt beneath the surface and left and forgotten. I've noticed my words have gravity, and I've seen them crush my family. But my mother, she chooses her words carefully to inspire me. So to my mother, I choose my words carefully. Katsu, katsu, zentai katsu. I will win, I will win. For my heart, I will win. Thank you.
My tour was cut short. My dad died when I was in Vietnam, and I was sole supporter of my mother and younger brother. Somehow the Army found out about that and gave me a honorable hardship discharge. My radio squawked and said, and then they said, Eric Hollenbeck, get in the chopper and come on back, you're getting out. So it caught me completely out of the blue.
I gave my papers to the people at Benoit, and they got me on a 707 headed home. Bill Hole's wife here in town was a stewardess on those 707s. And she said on the way over, the guys would jest with her, and they would be loud and boisterous. And she said, we'd land at Benoit, they'd get off, and the returning troops would get on, and there wouldn't be a word. It would be dead silent. And she said, we'd get in the air, and we'd walk up and down the aisles, and we'd say to them, would you like some coffee or tea or a Coke or something? And she said, all we'd get was blank stares. And I know that thousand-mile stare. Then we flew into Oakland, about 8:30, 9, 10 o'clock, sometime in the nighttime. I don't know when. They fed us, and there were four of us at this little dinner. And we had a steak dinner. As our food's brought to us, and we start eating, a lieutenant comes out to a podium, and he holds up the steak knife that we're using, and he says, welcome back. He says, this is now a steak knife. This cuts steak, it don't cut people no more. And then he holds up a deer rifle and he says, this is now a rifle. It's not a weapon anymore. It goes deer hunting. Okay, have a nice life. And then he left. And that was our detox, was this little dinner that we had, I guess. I was so numb. 2 o'clock in the morning was the paymaster, and that was the last thing. And he's got these bars in front of his window, and he shoves this whole wad of money out underneath the bars, and then he reaches out and drags it all back, save for $6.13. And he said, we overpaid you in Nam, and that's your DeRose pay right there, and the front door's right there. Go have a nice life. So I walk out onto the streets of Oakland at 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was $6.13 in my pocket. So I started hitchhiking. People picked me up, and anyway, about 5:30 in the morning, I'm on my side of the Golden Gate Bridge, and this wonderful man picks me up. And this guy might not have even been real. This guy might have been an angel or something. And he was a salesman, and he was going to Eureka. And he said, I'll take you all the way. And he never once, not one time, said anything about the war. Not once. He talked about, what do you think about those Dodgers? And he talked about fishing, and he talked about the streams in Humboldt County, and he talked about football, and nonstop, he just talked stuff. I didn't know none of that stuff, so I didn't, probably wasn't very good company, but he just kept talking and didn't make me feel less than or anything for not knowing. And then we got up almost to Scotia, and we got in that stretch, 10, 15 miles before Scotia, where that big timber, and I hung my head out the window and my hat blew off because I was looking at those trees because I'd thought about those trees my whole tour. That was my lighthouse, my beacon in the distance were those trees. And he saw the hat blow off and he says, you want me to, you know, turn around and get that? And I said, no, I don't want that hat. Then he said, would you like me to pull over and maybe you could sit under one of those trees for a minute? And I said, I would really like that. And he did. He pulled over and let me go sit underneath a redwood tree for 3, 4, 5 minutes. And then I got back in his car and it was, now what do you think about those Dodgers again? And never said boo about it, nothing. He just let me be. And he took me right to my door. And that's why I say that this, he might not have even been real. He could have very well just been an angel sent to take me that far because it was just too perfect.
A Echoes of War is an original production from Four on the Floor Theater and the Arcata Playhouse, and is partially funded by the California Humanities Community Stories Project. Echoes of War was produced by Allie Friedland, Jacqueline Dandenau, Zuzka Sabata, and me, Tammy Ray Scott. Thanks to audio engineer Russ Cole and post-production engineer Tim Gray. Special thanks to all the Echoes of War participants for their hard work and courage in sharing their stories. For more information and to view companion images to this broadcast, please visit our website at echoesofwar.org.